Thank you very much for this opportunity. I'd like to thank NIJ, NFSTC, Waterhole Software for giving me this chance to come up here and speak. I'm an investigator. I use information and exchange it with other units as a team all the time. And so I've never been accused of looking backwards. I'm always looking forward. So when I saw the initial presentation of FIDEX probably about a year ago, I was thinking, hey, you know, that's great for the lab. That's wonderful. They're going to be able to organize themselves with the prosecutor, hopefully. But what about me? What's that going to do for my investigations? And I'm going to go through, I'm going to outline some major cases that we worked where information exchange was good and some things weren't so good. And then I'm going to talk a little about cold case and where I think a project like this would fit into cold case as well. I'd like to talk about, the information that I'm going to share about two of the cases that I'm going to talk about, they're public records. One of them, the individual is still going to trial at the end of this year for about 8 murders. So it is public information, and so anything that I share with you is already out there in the public media as well. So if you want to play that first clip.
And homicides, 5 sexual assaults, 10 kidnappings.
Tonight, Phoenix police are finally saying case solved.
This man never again should be able to walk the streets of this valley or anywhere else in freedom.
The evidence that we used to review these cases consists of forensic evidence, physical evidence, and circumstantial evidence. All of this evidence points directly to Mark Hudeau as the one who has committed these crimes.
Police say they received 8,000 tips, interviewed 3,500 people, and followed up on 2,500 pieces of information. Not once did they come up with anyone but Godot. Still, his attorney says his client didn't do it.
I don't know if you caught those numbers that were put out there, and that's one of many investigations that we had going at the time that became an information and management nightmare. A good friend of mine, Richie Martinez, who is the president of the International Association of Law Enforcement Analysts, told me one time, you know what, Jim? Failing to manage your information will fail your investigation every time. And he's absolutely right. And so I learned that lesson a long time ago. Some of it was the hard way, and some of it, I think, as we look towards the future, we can manage this information much better. You know, I did a couple presentations, and I talked about all the crimes, serial crimes that we've had in Phoenix, and somebody came up after the presentation and said, I don't really want to come to Phoenix. And I thought it was because of Senate Bill 1070 that they were boycotting, but apparently it's because we do have some issues. Since I've been in the sex crimes unit since 1998, we have logged well over 60 serial rape suspects that we've investigated and arrested and prosecuted most of those. These three folks right here, and I'm going to talk about David Wilson at the top, Mark Godot on the left, and the serial shooter case. You can Google any of those, and there's so much information on the internet. But unfortunately for us, those three cases were occurring all at the same time. They totaled about right around 20 murders, and then probably somewhere in the vicinity of 20 rapes between those four individuals that we were trying to manage with three different investigative units. And guess where all that evidence and all that information was getting funneled to? The crime lab. So you talk about resources, and you talk about having to manage your resources. I'll talk a little bit later on about middle management and my term that I use for that. Some things you just, Hollywood can't write a better script. When we finally arrested Dave Wilson, we found out a bunch of things that we knew and really didn't know, and then came to find out later on. He was the son of a sergeant on our police department, and the unit that picked him up the night that we were doing surveillance, because we were managing our information in our crime analysis unit, was the same unit that his dad had just transferred out of as a supervisor. So about a month before he had left this unit, we picked him up that night on a trespassing, and then when we went to do the search warrant on his car, we look at his license plate. And what's that say to you? That's not Dr. Jekyll's. He laughed about that. He goes, oh, you think that says Dr. Jekyll's. That's DJ and Kelsey, his two kids. So as he would go out as Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and commit these crimes, he would go back to his two children. So Hollywood can't write these things sometimes any better. So we had to manage a lot of information, and our resources were very limited. It took a long time to get the wheels of the investigative process moving to where I knew we needed assistance, but I had to be able to go to these other units and convince them with this information. We have some solid ideas of what we want to do. We started to see patterns in our crime analysis of where he had tendencies of areas that he liked to commit his sexual assaults in. And so we were able to manage our resources, and we had five different surveillance teams in five different apartment complexes, including the apartment complex that he lived in, which managing just that part of the investigation. You have to understand, the apartment complex he lived in has its own zip code. That's how big this place was. And so we use information, we use crime analysis, and we use just some good old-fashioned gumshoe work, and ended up with Mr. Wilson one night in one of our surveillance areas. But this is the old school of how we would manage all of these sexual assault examination kits and any other evidence that was funneling through the lab. We didn't have a communication system that we could access in real time. We were having meetings every day. We would include everybody in these meetings. And I'll talk about, you know, working one of these major cases and the amount of information that gets shared or doesn't get shared and how that impacts your case. But as you can see, on the right-hand side, we were getting a lot of elimination samples from a lot of folks. And so we wanted to have that information back in real time, because if we have a surveillance team following one of our leads around, we wanted to know as quickly as we could, can we pull those resources away from that individual because we know that's not him. We were very fortunate in this case because we were getting DNA samples from those sexual assault kits that were early on linking these cases together. So they weren't hunches. It was actual solid information from the cases that was allowing us to link this together. And then we wanted to know who was screening it, and we would be able to go to that person and say, you know, what items were screened, what items weren't screened. We actually went line by line through these sexual assault kits. You know, they show up as one item usually when they get impounded and go to property, but when you open them up at the lab, I've seen as many, and I'm sure you have too, as many as 30, 35 different items inside the kit, depending on the circumstances of the case and how the nurse did the examination. So it became tracking this information a nightmare. And then we had to work, when we finally arrested him, we had to exchange, and we had to work information with our Maricopa County Attorney's Office. So we had to sit down with them, and we went through basically department report by department report, and we identified every count of sexual assault, kidnapping, everything we could on each one of those cases, and this is how we tracked it. This is how we exchanged the information. This is actually one of the, with my notes, this is actually one of the original pieces of paper they used for charging. We went to grand jury on this. And as you can see, we ended up with about 60-some counts on this individual. And then we had Mark Godot. It was interesting. The night that we arrested David Wilson, Mark Godot was in the west side of Phoenix raping two sisters at a park. We didn't know that at the time because all of our resources were concentrating on this big arrest with the media and everybody getting their ties on and their badges polished so they could go in front of the cameras. But he was out doing his second rape, and we were able to link those fairly early on through basically through his MO. What we did know in the end is, retrospect, looking back at the crimes that he was committing, became a very daunting task of trying to manage the information from not only homicides, armed robberies, sexual assaults, but a homicide that was outside our jurisdiction that happened in Tempe. It was one of his first homicides. We kind of got caught in the middle on this one. The information started flowing in as far as leads and tips and other types of communication that we weren't prepared to handle at the time. We didn't have a database. We didn't have a tracking system. It was one of these on the fly. Can we develop something? Go down to our IT people. Can you give us something? Because we're already behind the curve. And so it became very important for us to try to manage this, to see where we were, what we had, and where we were going to go with this investigation. Again, we started using the crime mapping, the crime analysis, to try to identify the areas in which he would have a tendency to maybe go back and offend. This is the first time in my 28 years my sister-in-law ended up living a quarter mile from where he lived. And he had committed up in the upper right-hand corner off of 32nd Street in Thomas. She lived at 33rd Street in Thomas. And it's the first time in my 28-year career I told my family, do not go out of your house between the hours of 7 p.m. and 10 p.m. because that was his prime time. That's what he liked. That's when he had some free time to do whatever he needed to do. We were 15 minutes away at preventing probably 7 murders. We had one surveillance guy that for whatever reason, he took an interest in our unit when we were trying to get resources and we couldn't. And he said, I'll tell you what do you guys think? And we said, we think he's going to be up around 32nd Street in Thomas. He sat there. He was part of the SWAT team. He sat there and he got a call out. He had to go to a barricade. 10 minutes later, our suspect commits an armed robbery, shooting, and attempt kidnapping a female. I can guarantee you that if Billy Clark, who's the surveillance officer, was there, he would have killed him, and we would have ended anything because he has a tendency to be a really, really good shot. That's why we put him there. Because that was the only way, he was either going to be dead or he was going to kill somebody. Obviously, he decided to start killing people. The other thing about information is the night that he raped the two girls, and we'll talk about the two sisters in the park, patrol ended up taking disposition on that. And they thought they had found the crime scene. Well, we brought them back in the next day for a comprehensive interview with one of our sex crimes investigators, and we realized they probably didn't have the right location. And so we went back out, and we found the location, and we actually identified additional evidence at that location. So now we have more evidence that we have to try to track, and that was very critical in the prosecution's case that they wanted to show to the jury. And, we had to say, hey, we missed it the first time, but we went out and got it the second time. So when you're talking about these major cases, you're talking about managing resources. You talk about managing people. And really, managing people is more like leading people, I would say. You manage things, production, output, but really team building, communication, that's what managing people is all about. But you can't do any of that unless you manage your information. And everybody's on the same page and has access to the same information, and everybody's heading in the right direction. And that becomes difficult at times. So when you're managing information, especially in one of these cases, tips, leads, evidence, communication becomes so critical. And, so how do you overcome those types of issues? I don't know if there is the pie in the sky that's going to solve every communication issue, every management issue of information out there. But I can tell you at least we're heading in the right direction. At least we're looking at solutions that I think can be applied to a variety of situations that we all get involved in. So this would be a typical communication breakdown or a communication a task force of how it would be developed. Can you imagine trying to manage all the individuals that are assigned to each one of those little boxes, as well as the information that's being exchanged? I mean, somebody would tell me something in a meeting, and the next day I'd never remember it. It wasn't getting documented, it wasn't getting exchanged, it wasn't getting massaged. We weren't mining the data like we should have been at that stage. And this is my futile attempt at PowerPoint stuff. So you set up a war room, and now you got a major case, and you've got all this information, this data, and you've got all this evidence and this stuff flowing in. Well, what actually happens to it? How do you, when you break it down, where does that information go? Someone has to deal with it, right? 8,000 tips. So how do you deal with 8,000 tips with the fear that the one tip that's in there that you don't do appropriate follow-up on is your suspect, and he goes out and commits an additional crime? So, when you think about, managing this information, there's got to be a process to do it. And we set up a little process Basically, when the information came in, no matter how it came in, this is how it worked. This is how it flowed. And hopefully, we were able to identify assess the good information and filter out the bad information that was not for us. Of course, sometimes you just don't know what happened in a case, and that's why we have homicide detectives. Yeah, I'll talk a little bit about cold case. We started in 2000 with a VAWA grant, and we have developed for the last 10 years a database, internal database, to track this information. I throw him in there because his name is Jack Russell, and I know that seems ironic, but he committed several sexual assaults in Phoenix and then fled to El Paso, Texas. But here you have a team, and how can you be a team if you don't communicate and understand the information that each other has and how it's important to share that with other folks? You cannot be successful in a team without the exchange of data, information, talking to each other, being able to look at archived data and massage it and pull out the stuff that's appropriate and that you need in your investigation or your prosecution or in the crime lab to test. And so, you know, you're a team, and you may not meet as a team per se, but you're all supposed to be heading in the same direction. You're supposed to be moving towards the goal. And the only way to do that is to have this information available to everybody. So when you're talking about cold case information management, you know, we talk about how we set up our team. We just didn't shotgun everything to the lab. Well, we kind of did, and then they panicked, and we gave them a body from our unit and said, here, use this person to screen some of these kits that we had back in 2000, 2001. But we went through our case. We reviewed our cases. We put them into a database. You know, we were able to track our leads, timelines, milestone dates on evidence, on talking to leads. I'll show you one of the screens we had. This is a very simple database that really is outdated at this point. But we continue to use it because at this point we're looking for options. We're looking for something in the future. You know, you need to track and review evidence and identify where your backlogs are, and as that evidence moves through your system, one of the questions that my detectives get asked when they go to grand jury on these cold cases is the grand jury wants to know timelines. Okay, when was that kit obtained? When was it sent to the lab? When was it examined? When did you get the CODIS hit? They want dates, and then, of course, the last question is why did it take so long? And then my detectives have to sit there and try to explain, you know, the process to the grand jury. But they're asking these questions. We wouldn't have that information unless we were able to track it effectively. You know, the other thing is statistics. You know, every time we would get a grant, we would have new requirements to provide statistical recap of what we accomplished. You know, people are giving us money. They have a right to know what we did with that money. And we should be able to give them numbers and explain exactly how that money was used and what it was used for. And hopefully they're successful numbers. We could do, you know, we're looking for a process to link cases, to look at series and analyze those series, for information that can be shared by a team and accessed by a team. You have to trust each other in that team, that information is going to be used as part of that investigation. You know, these cases are cold for a reason, and now we have to go back and bring them alive again. So it's just one of our basic admin sheets. You know, I can look at this and I can tell you that we have available evidence, and I can also tell you if there's DNA on a suspect. You know, there's a typical identified suspect offender in one of our cases. So I guess, you know, I'm saying we need to be prepared. We need to look to the future because I'm not going to be here in 10 years doing this. But I want to leave it for somebody that's not a mess that they have to clean up, that they have to start all over from scratch. We're here doing the job now. We need to ensure that we're doing it effectively and efficiently and managing this information for really the future. Don't become a middle manager. You know, when you're at 30,000 feet in an airplane, that's not the time to think about, well, we should have built a better airplane. You know, it's too late. You're up in the air. And that usually is what happens. We manage by crisis. The crisis is gonna be here. There was a presentation last week at the Death Symposium in Scottsdale, and they were talking about 9/11. You know how much information, pieces of data, millions and millions of pieces of data, that they had to track, from everything from forensic information to lead information to dealing with families. They had to build something on the fly. Don't put yourself in that position. And it's very hard to get your administration to look at this as a real issue. I'm sure you've been in a jurisdiction where they've had some sort of a plane crash, you know, with mass fatalities, where now you've got to manage all that, not just the crime scene, but manage all that information that's occurring on the fly. Know where you're going in order to get there. And then we have.
According to police, he terrorized the valley for months. Tonight, the accused baseline killer, Mark Goodoe, knows how long he'll spend behind bars for the sexual assault of two sisters.
Mark Goodoe in court as he's sentenced to 438 years in prison. Here's an idea of how long that is. 438 years ago, in 1569, William Shakespeare was just 5 years old. And the first colony in the United States would not be settled for another 38 years.
Amazing what the media will come up with. What does William Shakespeare have to do with a serial rapist and murderer? I'm really proud of the teamwork and the cooperation. We made it through this crisis, and you know, the case, the information, the lab work, it withstood a very vigorous defense in trial and convicted him 438 years. And that's really what we're working for, and I thank you very much.